From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., which is once again open for business and for fights and a whole lot of other stuff. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help us keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Al-Qaeda-linked rebels have attacked a Christian village in Syria, home to one of the world's oldest monasteries.
Crisis in Egypt and a call for help from Christians,
asking them the name of the Prophet Muhammad's mother to prove their faith.
We've often talked about the irresponsible ways that the term religious liberty has been misappropriated by a small minority in this country and is increasingly used to defend one's right to discriminate. Sadly, many of those who make the most noise about these imaginary attacks on freedom are often the most notably silent when true threats to religious freedom emerge around the world. On this week's show, I'll talk about this with the Reverend Brian McLaren.
Whatever you did for any of my people, no matter how unimportant they seem, you did to me.
As the government shutdown wore on, a diverse group of faith leaders and supporters gathered daily across the U.S. Capitol building for what came to be known as the Faithful Filibuster. Among those present was author and activist Reverend Jim Wallace, and Jim will be with us on this week's show to talk about the role of prayer in public life as he sees it. In other words, I'll be asking if the Faithful Filibuster gets the credit for averting a breach of the debt ceiling. But first,
according to Standard & Poor's, the shutdown will shave fourth quarter economic growth from 3% to 2.4%. Total cost to the economy, $24 billion.
The first government shutdown of the 21st century is over. Regardless of politics, the past few weeks have taken a toll across our nation. With the national news media concentrated in New York and Washington, this took on the tone of an inside the Beltway story. But everyday Americans far from Washington, D.C., were deeply affected. And this highlights the growing disconnect between our elected leaders and ordinary Americans, including mainstream people of faith. Doran Schranz is the director of Isaiah, a faith-based community organization of 100 member congregations in Minnesota. And I am really pleased to have her join us now on State of Belief Radio. Doran, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Isaiah has coordinated across a wide range of issues in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Were the specific challenges that had to be addressed in the region due to the federal government shutdown, or were they there already?
The challenges that people are facing every day have been there already. The problem with the shutdown, I think you summed up very well, which is that it was completely out of touch and unaccountable to the struggles that people have in their everyday life with their families and their communities.
I just have to assume, knowing the kind of work that you do, when you hear the debate in Washington, and especially on fiscal issues, that you must feel a disconnect between the people into whose faces you're looking and whose families you're serving, and then what politicians are discussing. Would that assumption be correct?
That assumption is very correct. I got into this work. I'm actually originally from Iowa. I'm an Iowa girl, and I have been a Midwesterner my whole life. And I got into this work that I do today, both because of my faith, but also because of the economic devastation that I saw in my small town in Iowa when I grew up there during the 80s. And I really decided when I saw the farm crisis and what happened to people in terms of their work at meatpacking plants and in agriculture, when those people got laid off, that it just really wasn't okay to leave people behind. And so I think we're in a very similar struggle today. And my hope and aspiration is that regular people and people of faith and people in, as you said, mainstream people of faith in America, when they engage in the struggle of bringing their real stories into the center of our politics, that's when our politics can work.
Mm-hmm.
And when our public officials and our elected officials are not accountable to the struggles of real people, politics does not work. And this shutdown was a very good example of just the huge chasm that exists between the conversation that's happening in Washington and, for example, the conversation that we're having here on the ground with a young woman who's very active in our organization. Her name is Gracia. She's a dreamer. That means that she came here undocumented, but now she's going to the University of Minnesota under deferred action. But she has been organizing and organizing because her father was deported when she was 11, and she has a 2-year-old, and her husband is undocumented. And I have to tell you that when I see her grace and her courage and her dedication to bringing her church family and her own family out into the public arena to try to talk to her representative, Representative Eric Paulson, about what's at stake for her and the crisis that she faces every day, this shutdown sucked all the oxygen away from the conversation that Gracia needs to have in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consequence, the catastrophe, is not just what happened to the hundreds of thousands of government employees and people who may not get their food stamps, but the catastrophe is also that the stories of Gracia, or the stories of Mary, whose home was foreclosed on, or Bob, who I know who's working 2 jobs, even though he was trained as an engineer, Bob and Arlene and Gracia's stories are not at the center of our political conversation. And that's what's a catastrophe.
Yeah. I want you to tell us a little bit about the way Isaiah came together, its history, and then we'll talk about some of what you do there.
Isaiah is a vehicle for people of faith and congregations and faith communities to act collectively on their values for racial and economic justice. And we've been around here in Minnesota in various incarnations for about 20 years. And we operate primarily out of a model of grassroots community organizing, but in a faith-based context.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that, like when Gracia is an Isaiah volunteer leader, or some of the other people I mentioned, Bob or Arlene, they're coming into the public conversation first and foremost as people of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So we ground people in their identity first as people of faith, and then we work together to say together and collectively we can have a more powerful voice to impact the things that really matter to people in their lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The kinds of issues we work on, they're grounded in our values, but they tend to be things that are really coming from the struggles that people have in their lives. So we've worked on things like foreclosures, because we did this round of surveys in a set of about 25 congregations and realized that people were really struggling with foreclosure. And so a whole team of leaders and clergy got together, and we ended up working to pass some of the best foreclosure mediation legislation in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So when people get together and they put their own stories into the public, and then they engage with their public officials and hold them accountable, we have also seen that real differences can be made. We can really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Bachman.
Yes.
It's not a question. I just was curious what your reaction would be. Well, and actually I say it too because I want to ask you how religion comes into play with the kind of work you do.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get Ms. Bachman, you get some kind of religion up front, but not necessarily the justice of initiatives that you've talked about.
Yeah.
After you get it.
We could have a 3-hour conversation about that.
I bet.
So we've talked a lot over the years about the role of religion in the political debate in America.
Right.
And one way to think about it is that the role of religion, or what religion is, or who religious people are, is being contested at a national and local level. What we believe privately about our faith is what we believe collectively. There's theological debates through all that. But then the identity of who speaks for religious communities is being contested, and it's a struggle in
mm-hmm.
the public narrative and in the public arena. And so we believe that the particular views of whether Michelle Bachman or not, but there's a particular view of what it means to be Christian that Michelle Bachman certainly does not speak for the majority of Christians either in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And that there is a much more full view of what it means, and in particular I'm speaking from a Christian perspective, of what it means to be a Christian. And that part of our role and responsibility in the public arena, and part of what's so important of having real people's voices, not just people speaking for other people, is that we need other people standing up to say, this is what being a Christian means to me. And we need clergy standing up and saying, this is the theology of compassion and justice and economic dignity, that all of those conversations are also what it means to be a Christian.
Yeah. When you talked about those very specific people and what their needs were and how you all responded, at least in my mind, you were speaking much more profoundly about faith and religion than someone who stands up on a stump speech and quotes scripture or says what doctrines you've got to believe. And that leads me to ask you, what are the biggest challenges that you face right now?
We have to make our politics work for regular people. And until we do that, our politics will be fundamentally unaccountable and broken. And what we saw play out over the last 6 months, over the last 6 weeks, I would argue it's been on a trajectory in this direction for years. People have to put their own stories back in the center of the public debate, and that means holding their elected officials accountable to them. And so I feel like there's a lot of hope and possibility. There are countless organizations like Isaiah. There's people all over the country. I mean, the day that Gracia, along with hundreds of other people, we organized a march on immigration, and 4,000 people came out for that march. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. I think people in 2014 need to make it very clear in the election, whether you're talking to Republicans or Democrats, like wherever you see yourself in whatever camp, our public officials have to be accountable to real people and the struggles that real people are engaging in. And if they're not, they need to be held accountable, and people need to show that at the ballot box.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think we have to not play in to the toxic debate that's unfolding and actually put the power of real people at the center in the public debate. And until we do that, we're just going to get this spinning around and spinning around.
Coming off the shutdown and knowing that in just a couple of months or so, the whole thing could repeat itself.
Yeah.
If you had a chance to speak to Congress, what would you say to them?
I would say, come and meet Gracia. Come and meet Arlene. Come and meet Bill. Come and meet Bob. Like, actually come into communities and meet someone who's struggling with whether or not they're going to be able to get their food stamps. Until Congress is in relationship with the reality of everyday Americans, they are not going to be accountable, and they're going to slip further and further down this path to something destructive.
I really wish they could speak with Doran Schrantz, who is the director of Isaiah, a faith-based community organization of 100 member congregations in Minnesota, with significant achievements in areas including transportation, health care, and social justice, among others. What she has said to us is profoundly important. What she would say to government officials, equally important. Doran Schrantz, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for this program. It's really important that this kind of program is on the air.
Later in the show, the disconnect between religious liberty rhetoric and reality with the Reverend Brian McLaren. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. For many years, the Reverend Jim Wallace has been a prominent voice in progressive religion, confusing those who assume evangelical Christianity is necessarily a conservative movement, writing best-selling books and serving as editor-in-chief of Sojourners, the magazine he founded over 40 years ago. Jim, thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Great to be with you again.
With all eyes on the U.S. Capitol, I want you to talk about the faithful filibuster. I know it involved reading some scriptures and prayer at the Capitol. Tell our folks why you felt it was important to be there and what you were doing.
Well, you know, Weldon, as you and I have often talked about, sometimes it's difficult to know how to bring faith into public life that brings the prophetic nature of biblical faith to bear, but is one that's done with respect for all the pluralism of this country, which is growing every day. And so on Monday, a week ago, last Monday, we were in a conversation, several of us, what to do about this terrible crisis. The Circle of Protection was having a steering committee phone call, and we decided to just go pray at the Capitol. So 2 days later, we're out there, and we decided to read the 2,000 verses in the Bible about the poor. There's actually 2,000 verses about poverty and wealth and justice and injustice. Mm-hmm. We figured out it took 7 hours to read all 2,000 verses. And we did that every day Congress was in session to read those verses. The words we all saw across the street that were hurting the country, the words of just babble and confusion and political ambition, and the whole story for the media was who won the news cycle today. That's all they were asking. Mm-hmm. It was all winning and losing and not serving the common good, especially the poor. So we read about the poor and God's concern for the poor. And some of the verses are about what kings should do and rulers and their responsibilities. So we just kept reading, and people kept coming, and social media began to take off. Young people came, and pastors would drive from Ohio to just do a reading. And finally, we decided to start sunrise and go pray. This is the big day for the vote. We didn't know what would happen. We decided just to go pray. And we did, and it was a really powerful time. And then three women senators, Republican senators, who were trying to find some way out of this, were on the Today Show, and they were out there filming that, and they saw us. They came over, and they joined us. Mm-hmm. So we prayed with those three women Republican senators, who I think really played a critical role, as all the women did behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Murkowski and Collins and Iote, and they were really, they're all Catholics, and they really wanted to pray. So, mysteriously, you never know the role prayer plays, but reading the Bible about those 2,000 verses helps to prepare us now for this budget debate that's going to ensue again.
Jim, the way you introduced the story by saying, we said, well, let's just go pray, did fit what I imagine some people's attitude was, which was everything else has failed, so let's try prayer.
Right.
And it was that kind of moment. The only criticism I heard, and I'd like for you to respond to it, was there are always people, and especially if they don't particularly like the message that you're carrying, who will say, well, Jesus said we ought to just pray at a closet, not go up to the Capitol or not be seen praying. How do you respond to people who take that approach?
I think for most of us people of faith, most of our prayers, and they say the same thing about fasting, prayers and fasting are mostly done in private places to deepen our own faith. But biblically, there is also examples of prayer and even fasting in a public sense. And certainly Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement and social movements that you and I are very, very moved by have used prayer and used the scriptures. And King had a way of raising the Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other hand, mm-hmm. and respecting both. So people who saw us, they all weren't Christians, they all weren't people of faith. But our young interns, I had dinner with them all last night, and they had just arrived, so they were really jumping into this. And they said all kind of people came up, and, you know, scruffy clothes and business suits and old and young and black and white, and they all were giving thumbs up and glad someone's doing this. And, you know, mostly it was in the rain last week. Well, do you remember how rainy it was? Mm-hmm. So that old Bible, the Bible is worth telling the story. It's called the Poverty and Justice Bible, put out by the American Bible Society and World Vision. And it has all the verses about the poor underlined in the Bible in orange. Hmm. So they're all right there. And we use that Bible. It's very waterlogged now. It's an old, wet Bible. And we were standing there in the rain with umbrellas over our heads. And, like, I'd hold the umbrella for the reader and then the reader to hold it for me. And, you know, it wasn't like huge crowds of people and press cameras everywhere. It was often just ourselves out there in the rain reading the Bible.
Yeah.
And I said to my team, I said, we're going to call this the Faithful Filibuster, emphasis on the word faithful, mm-hmm. because it might just only be faithful, might not be effective at all. Reading the words of Scripture about what God wants us to do and respond to those who are poor and vulnerable and strangers and widows and orphans and it was very renewing to me again, having preached from this, and you have too, this stuff our whole lives, to read those words in contrast to the words across the street at the Capitol was really a very moving thing for many of us.
I'm sure. Do you think we're making any progress in helping people understand the proper role of religion in a political environment? In other words, if we've got enough Christians, as we do, in the House and the Senate, that if they were voting their values as Christians coincides with the value of providing for the public welfare in a democracy, then we should be all right. But we know that's not happening, and that there is as much division in religion as there is in politics. How do we help people understand that?
You know, it's interesting watching some of these issues play out now on immigration reform. We have a profound unity among people of faith. The Southern Baptists and Sojourners now stand side by side in this. And the National Council of Churches and the National Association of Evangelicals, our friend David Saperstein, all the rabbis are with us on this issue of how we treat the stranger. And the Bible is very clear on that. Sometimes religion wants to take power and ram its agenda down people's throats with political power. That's not the proper role, in my view. We rather lift up these words to change how we think and how we behave. And King knew that reading Jeremiah didn't produce a Civil Rights Act. Reading Jeremiah and Jesus made people think about their values. And then, as you say, many people in the Congress are people of faith, at least they say so. But often they're not voting on those values. It's political ambition, ideology, fundraising, what does the base want, how do I not be primaried, all of those political things, which I understand. But I think reminding people of not that they should be proselytized, but that our faith reminds us of the values that need to shape our common life. Or as you say, the Constitution says general welfare. You and I might say the common good.
Right.
And to remind them that there's 11 million undocumented families out there, and putting their lives back together is something that we as people of faith want to do. The business community has decided it's good for business, too, and law enforcement says this would be better for law enforcement. So you begin to build alliances, but the faith community can be a catalytic role about what are the moral values here that we often forget in Washington.
Right.
That's
right.
The issue.
Yeah. My guest is the Reverend Jim Wallace, editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine and the author of numerous books, the latest of which is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Jim, I want to talk about the book. Tell us a little bit about what it is that religion forgets and politics hasn't learned.
You know, well, we put the book out about 6 months ago, and if you'd asked me then if things would have gotten this bad, I probably wouldn't have imagined they'd gotten this bad. Whatever happened to the common good becomes the question here. It's an ancient idea that I talk about in the book going back centuries in Christian faith and certainly in the Hebrew scriptures, in Islam, in most of our faith traditions, this idea of the common good, loving our neighbor as ourselves. That's the spiritual foundation for it. So I try to apply that to economy, to the role of government, to democracy, what it means to see democracy as growing out of our being created in the image of God. And I think this idea really does transcend our left and right political dichotomies. And it draws us back to how do we not just take care of ourselves, but take care of each other. And that's really the foundation for a healthy society. So I try to lay out that sort of historically, biblically, theologically, but then also apply it to the things we're facing now today.
Jim, when we see what we have just seen over the last 2 weeks, and we think about the government's leaders' responsibility to look at the common good, where do you find hope for change?
We have to remember that hope is never a feeling, because sometimes, like the last 2 weeks, we don't feel a lot of hope. I mean, I confess the last 2 weeks I've not felt very hopeful. But as Desmond Tutu taught me years ago, hope and optimism are not the same thing. Hope is not a feeling, it's a decision we make because of this thing we call faith. Hebrews says, no, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And my best paraphrase of that is hope means believing in spite of the evidence, then watching the evidence change. Mm-hmm. So we went out and prayed this faithful filibuster, and it seemed kind of hopeless and kind of fruitless, and to go out and read all the verses in the Bible about the poor 7 hours a day while they're in session. But the response from an awful lot of people, young people on social media, Twitter, young pastors driving in from the Midwest to read with their parishioners, a whole lot of furloughed workers would come and they would read. And it was a very hopeful experience for them, and watching them read became a hopeful experience for me. And then at the end, some of the women in the Senate decided to provide leadership and became, I think, the only elders up there. And they came to join us in our prayer circle. So when things look their worst, often things happen that surprise us. And that's what Desmond Tutu taught me. It's a decision, and maintaining that hope is what always keeps the real chance of change alive. And our job is to keep acting in hope, even when there isn't much sign of it.
Jim, would you talk just a minute about how narrowly much of the public has come to see evangelical Christianity? What should people know about the progressive evangelical movement that expands their understanding and deepens their appreciation, or begins appreciation for them about the progressive evangelical movement?
Well, as you know, Sojourners reaches across all the Christian boundaries, and we work interfaith and with all kinds of people, even people who aren't people of faith. But I still call myself an evangelical Christian, because the word, it goes back to the word evangel in the scriptures. It means good news. In Jesus' first sermon at Nazareth, he used that term, his mission, the Spirit of the Lord's anointing me to bring good news, the evangel. Good news is the word, to the poor. So evangelical is supposed to be good news, and probably that's the last thing people would think of often when they hear the word evangelical. It's often bad news, or people telling me where I'm wrong, or what I have to do, or how I need to be different, how I need to behave in their eyes. And that's not what the word's supposed to mean. Good news. So how do you bring good news? And it says, if our gospel isn't good news to the poor, the marginal, the outsiders, it isn't the gospel of Jesus. So I'm going to hang on to the biblical meaning of that word, even though a lot of what is called evangelical really does embarrass me and often breaks my heart. But maybe that capital E is the cultural, often religious right religion. My father used to say, who was an evangelical, he said, those aren't evangelicals, those are fundamentalists. And I think that's true. I think a lot of the religious right, they're religious fundamentalists, and we have fundamentalists in all of our traditions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, certainly. So that fundamentalism, which is about control and power, is not about the gospel of love and justice. And I'm an evangelical because I believe the good news is about justice and love.
Knowing that, knowing what we just finished, knowing that in a few weeks we could be faced by a similar challenge, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic?
What I'm hopeful about is how, like, our circle of protection, it brings together evangelicals, mainstream Protestants, Catholic bishops, black churches, Hispanic, Asian American churches, pretty broadly. And the immigration table, the evangelical immigration table, is Southern Baptist, even focused on the family, has joined us under new leadership now out there in Colorado around immigration. And so I'm hopeful about the unity I see growing among people of faith around the poor, the vulnerable, the stranger, immigrant, those who are left out and left behind. That's hopeful. Politically, they're more and more locked into their polarization, paralyzation. And that's why I wrote this book, because it's really, we've lost the common good. So, you know, we're trying to talk over there to them about the common good, and some of them are, they want to talk about that, but they're stuck in their old patterns. But the common good comes last to Washington. I think movements, social movements, as you and I know, civil rights and abolition, women's movements, they start in the culture when people and people of faith act on what they know is true, and that builds social movements, and finally that can change the wind in Washington. But you don't look for things to start first in Washington. They usually come last to Washington, the good things.
The Reverend Jim Wallace is editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine and the author of numerous books, the latest of which is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. He was part of the Faithful Filibuster event across from the U.S. Capitol building during the government shutdown these past days. Jim, I thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My brother, it's always a delight to be with you.
Regular listeners to this show may remember the Reverend Brian McLaren from his visit with us back in 2010 when his book, A New Kind of Christianity, 10 Questions That Are Transforming the Faith, was published. And then he was back last year with a new book, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. Since that time, Brian has been busy with his ministry and activism, and I'm really pleased to have him back with us again on State of Belief Radio. Brian, welcome.
Great to be with you again, Welton.
You've been expressing your concern about the lack of overtly Christian voices when it comes to attacks on Christians around the world, and I'd like to start right there, if you'd talk about that.
Well, I think like a lot of people, I just felt a chill run up my spine with this terrible attack from the Al-Shabaab group in Nairobi. They did a kind of a quiz on people to identify who were Muslims and who weren't. And if you weren't a Muslim, then you were killed in this act of terrorism. And so Christians were really being singled out. And it's really been a little surprising how quiet Christian voices have been about what's happening both in specific instances like this when Christians are singled out, but also in just the general state of Christianity in major parts of the world, especially parts of the Muslim world, where Christians have been really having to flee places like Palestine, Iraq, Iran, and so on. So the total population of Christians in these countries is plummeting as Christians just leave. They can't manage to live there anymore.
Mm. Do you see a difference in the way so-called progressive Christians and so-called conservative Christians respond to news about that kind of dilemma?
Very much so. But here's the irony. Both progressive and conservative Christians are surprisingly silent about what's happening. And I think there's a reason on each side. I think for conservative Christians, they know that the reason many Christians, especially in the Middle East, are suffering persecution is because of U.S. support, both for wars in the Middle East, a kind of unquestioned U.S. support for the state of Israel, mm-hmm. and unwillingness of the United States and of the Christian community in the United States to speak out about problems with Israeli government policy. So you almost get the feeling that they feel that for their unquestioned support of Israel, they're willing to bargain away the well-being of Christians in the Middle East. I think for progressive Christians, it's a little different. They've heard so much anti-Islamic rhetoric from often conservative Christians that they just don't want to be associated with that at all. And the tragic result of this is that then Christians in the Middle East suffer and nobody is raising their voice on their behalf. Hmm. You know, I don't believe that we should be more concerned about Christian suffering than we are Muslim suffering or Jew suffering or atheist suffering. In other words, I think a truly Christian approach is to be concerned about every human being. But in this case, ironically, it's Christians in Muslim-majority countries often who suffer a great deal, and no one is there to speak up for them.
Hmm. Do you think, Brian, that the dilution of the concepts of religious freedom and religious liberty for political purposes in recent years may have contributed to some of this?
I do. And I think, sadly, if people have conflicted interests, if they have a number of interests, and some of those interests conflict with one another, they tend to tone down their concern. Hmm. So, for example, if there's a lack of religious freedom in countries from whom we like to buy oil, then you find that we're not as upset about violations of, or we aren't as outspoken about violations of religious freedom. If there's a country that we don't have so many interests entangled with, you know, then we might be a little quicker to speak out. Again, I'm not condoning this. I think it's an explanation, but certainly not an excuse.
Sure. There's a dimension to this that I want to mention, and I don't want it to be compared with what you're talking about, because I certainly agree in that what you're talking about is a very important issue in itself. But I have seen the cry of martyrdom or the cry of we're being persecuted by some people in the religious right who are simply talking about having to obey the law of religious freedom.
Yes.
And then in fundraising letters and so forth, they talk about the persecution of Christians. And it would be laughable were it not so serious, because they don't know what persecution is. Yes. In relation to the kinds of things you're talking about.
Well, this is where it really gets complicated, and it's where I think we need a kind of even-handed commitment to human rights and to religious freedom everywhere. So that means we have to be upset about Muslims who are being mistreated mm-hmm. in Tennessee and be upset about Christians who are pushed to second-class status in Pakistan.
Right.
For example, a former U.S. congressman sent around a letter, it was just about a year ago, decrying terrible things happening to Christians in the Muslim world. And he was asking people to sign on with a statement that he'd put together. But when I read that statement, I felt, you know, this just feels like it's part of a kind of an attempt to stir up Islamophobic sentiment. And it felt like there was a hidden agenda in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so people love to use victimhood for other purposes. What I think we have to do is try to just keep things clean and fair and true and say anyone who's being victimized because of their religious identity, along, I would say, with their sexual identity, mm-hmm. their political identity, and so on, we have to stand up for human rights for all people. And this puts us in these cross currents of political gamesmanship where victimhood is used for other purposes.
Yeah, that's very well said. What are you working on now? What's your focus? Anything new?
Sure. Well, actually, I'd love to explain that, but a memory is coming back. I want to miss the chance
okay.
to say something about. A few years ago, I got to spend quite a bit of time on the West Bank in Palestine, and I met with Christians. Some were Pentecostal, some were Orthodox, some were Catholic, but sincere, committed Palestinian Christians, and again, they just felt, why are we being forgotten?
Hmm.
And they feel this prejudice against Palestinians, especially in the American political community, and often in the Christian community.
Yes.
And they just thought, we're being forgotten. And that really does tie in with the writing project I'm working on now,
okay.
Because I've been working on a book. It will be called We Make the Road by Walking. It's kind of a journey through the biblical story. And one of the themes that I keep coming up against in the biblical story is this theme of, does God play favorites, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to be faithful, does this mean that we are faithful to some people and less faithful to others? In the biblical story, does a vision of God emerge that says everybody's important?
Mm-hmm.
And, oh my goodness, when you read the Bible with that question in mind, different things just start to glow.
Mm. Brian, you write these books, and we talk about it on State of Belief. Other people talk about it. I brag on the books and say you're doing exactly the kind of writing that needs to be done today. I know that not everybody agrees with that. And I see some of the criticism that you get. I mean, we all have that blessing, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, when criticism comes, and sometimes it seems to come in overloads, what keeps you engaged in your work? How do you keep from getting so frustrated you say, well, if they're going to react like that, I'm never going to write another book?
Yeah. I wish I could say that I never get disgusted or angry or defensive or whatever, but I certainly do sometimes. But one of my mentors, he actually just passed away a few months ago. His name was Dallas Willard, and Dallas was very kind to me. You know, I come from an evangelical background, and when a lot of my fellow evangelicals were writing me off. Dallas was still a faithful friend. And years ago, he gave me this little Xerox copy of a prayer that was written by a Serbian Orthodox bishop. And this bishop had been imprisoned by the Nazis, and he apparently had spoken to some of the priests under his care about how wrong the Nazis were. And sure enough, as soon as they came to power in the former Yugoslavia, he was thrown into prison. And so he knew that he had been betrayed by one of the priests under his care. And so here he found himself in prison, and instead of being really worried about his own safety or whatever, he was just consumed with fury for whoever it was who betrayed him. And he kind of realized, look, if I'm going to die, I don't want to die in this state of revenge and anger and fury. And so his spiritual struggle in prison was articulated in this prayer called A Prayer for Enemies. And it's easy to find if anyone were to go on my website, which is brianmclaren.net, and just look up Prayer for Enemies. It will come right up because I posted it there. But that prayer helped me so much because, you know, we all maybe believe in theory that we should love our enemies, but actually getting there when we've been criticized or hurt or mistreated, it's a struggle. And I'll just give you a couple of lines from the prayer that really helped me. Just as a hunted animal finds safer shelter than an unhunted animal, says, so I, pursued by my enemies, have found safer shelter in the shadow of your wings. Well, what that's meant for me is to say, look, the fact that I'm outspoken and being criticized for some reasons, I'm either going to react badly or I'm going to have to go deeper into God and deeper into, you know, my spirit and deeper into seeking a deeper kind of shelter. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's really, really helped me. I don't have the whole thing memorized. It's several pages long, but it's something that I just keep going back to again and again.
The Reverend Brian McLaren is a popular public speaker, author, activist, catalyst. His books include A New Kind of Christianity, 10 Questions That Are Transforming the Faith, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road, Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, before we go, more than one highlight or lowlight of the just-ended government shutdown made it into late-night comedy routines and parody performances. But I suspect this may have been the first time that a chaplain of the U.S. Senate found himself portrayed on Saturday Night Live.
Let us play.
Yeah, I thought so.
Lord, send a flood to Washington and just drown everybody. And waters to carry them to a place far, far away.
With religious leaders praying publicly across from the Capitol building and the Senate's own chaplain chastising the legislature's irresponsibility, one could be forgiven for thinking that our government had reached a new low. Remember a couple of years ago when Governor Rick Perry was saying that the only way to deal with natural disasters in Texas was through collective prayer? That sounded pretty out there at the time. Well, now that kind of thing seems almost commonplace. Now, I have nothing against prayer, but it's no substitute for sound public policy, nor, frankly, should it be a substitute for straight talk when such straight talk is called for. The Reverend Barry Black may have been speaking out of desperation when he said the following.
Have mercy upon us, O God, and save us from the madness. Deliver us from the hypocrisy of attempting to sound reasonable while being unreasonable.
Maybe it would have been out of line for the Senate chaplain to sternly lecture the behaving badly caucus in his role as a responsible adult or a taxpayer or a voter, so perhaps he felt this was the only possible course of action for him. But in this case, as in many other cases, it can become an abdication of our individual and collective responsibility as diverse people of faith and of no faith to seek a divine intervention when we are more than blessed with the resources to solve many of these problems ourselves. And it goes without saying that if those prayers get sectarian, you'll alienate some members of the community that may have been best equipped to help solve the problem in the first place. Look, if one decides to go joyriding late one night in a car with no brakes and no headlights after consuming a generous amount of Jack Daniels, is it responsible for that person to pray, no matter how fervently, while speeding down the highway? Should that be enough, assuming one's faith is strong? What I'm suggesting is that we be careful not to abdicate responsibility for the admittedly serious challenges of our world, economic uncertainty, social injustice, climate change, and so much more, and then turn at the last moment to a higher power to save us. It's not the way politics should work, and it's certainly not the way prayer works. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time, unarguably, when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Please stay in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. We have a listener line. The number is 800-856-0277. We encourage you, as always, to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen to. And then please join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.